Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, why are the Dutch so good and Americans so bad at sex ed?
While Dutch parents were not necessarily more comfortable talking about sex than American parents, Dutch parents talk about balancing responsibility and joy. American parents emphasized risk and danger.
If you're a parent struggling with how to talk with your child, or a young person searching to educate yourself about sex, Peggy Orenstein may have the information you need. Her new book is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. In this excerpt, we're presenting the core of Orenstein's recent conversation with Katie Sewell at Town Hall Seattle. You can hear the full program, including questions and answers, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this conversation contains information of a sexual nature about sexual education. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for our recording. And a quick note, Anna is leaving Speakers Forum to focus on a business she started. Anna did great work for us, and we're going to miss her a lot, especially her lecture notes, which were always a treat. Anna, this dramatic pause was for you.
Hello, everyone. And thank you, Peggy, for being here. Thank you, Women's Funding Alliance. And I just want to say that before we came out here, we both discovered that we were from Minnesota. And the odds that two Minnesotans would be casually talking about girls and sex would be something I would never imagine as a child.
But we're not Scandinavian.
Yeah, we're not Scandinavian. Maybe that helps. But it does stand to reckon that we are going to be pretty frank and not shy tonight, and hopefully everyone will feel great about that.
I'm never shy, Katie.
No, we'll find out just how unshy you are tonight. Let me start by, maybe this would explain how not shy you are. You talk to a lot of young women about their sex lives for this book. Can you explain how you went around finding those women and who they were?
Yeah, so I talked to roughly 70 young women between the ages of 15 to 20. And they spanned a pretty broad ethnic range, but they were all either college-bound or in college. And I chose, and I found them in all different ways. I mean, they, you know, friends of friends of friends. When I go to colleges and speak, I'd put out an email. If I was at an event like this, I'd say, hey, I'm writing a book. If anybody wants to talk to me, come up to me and I'll get your email address. All kinds of ways. But I purposely picked this group, this demographic, because I wanted to talk to girls who we think of as having opportunity, and the girls that we think of as being the beneficiaries of the feminist movement. Because, you know, if those girls who are effective in school, who can speak out, where we've made all this progress for them in their education, all this progress for them professionally, they're political, they're forthright, they're like leaning in all over the place, you know? If even they were toppling in their personal lives, then it would be hard to deny that we had a problem.
Now, how did you make the, why do you think they volunteered? I guess that's the real question. Why did they want to tell their story?
I think in part because nobody ever asked them. I would get that a lot, that they had never had the opportunity to sit and think through and talk about issues relating to their intimate lives, and they were kind of hungry to do so. And in fact, you know, not, I mean, people say, how did I get them to talk so frankly to me? And there was really no trick to that. I just asked and listened. And I will say that the first couple of interviews that I did, just between you guys and me, I totally bombed. And I interviewed these couple of girls, and then I wanted to, and I was so kind of taken aback by what they were telling me that I think I just kind of was going, what? What? What did you just say? And later, I wanted to do some follow-up with them, and they wouldn't respond to me. I tried emailing, I tried texting, I tried Facebooking, no response. So I guess I did have a learning curve where I had to learn how to speak to girls so that they would know I was there to hear them and to hear them in a non-judgmental way and to bring their voices forward so that we could all have this conversation around what was going on with them.
So is there any way, before we really get into this, some of the nitty-gritty topics, for you to, I don't know, change the mind of any parent who sits here and thinks, now that's not my child. Like, she's not the same as those girls in your book.
Ask.
Ask.
No, you know, I don't know if it's your... I don't know. But I can say that it's the book provides a place where you can have that discussion. Or even if you just listen to one of the interviews, a lot of people tell me that they listen to the Fresh Air interview that I did with their kids, and it sparks a lot of discussion, whether it's about them or about their friends or about the world that they're in. It's a way to start talking to them. And whether or not your child is sexually active, however we want to define that, and we're going to discuss how we're going to define that, they still need to learn about ethics, responsibility, safety, reciprocity, pleasure, entitlement. So that is your that's everybody's child.
Yeah. I'm debating on whether or not we should talk terms first before we get into porn. But I think I'm going to go with terms first. How would you say that the word, what does the word empowerment mean to girls today? Young women, teenage girls, college girls.
I hate that word. I try not to use it because it's one of those words that's been so co-opted. It basically means, like, you know, your power to go out and buy lipstick or something. I'm not sure. But I think what you're really asking is, you know, with my previous book, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, I was looking at the culture of little girlhood, and I was looking at the ways that marketing from the very youngest ages was telling girls that how they looked was more important than who they are. And I was concerned about that because I'm a mom, too, and I have a daughter who's now almost 13. And so when I got to this book, I became much more conscious about how that kind of pink and pretty message became about hot. And hot is sold to girls. I mean, it's such a narrow, commercialized, superficial idea of what's sexy and what's attractive. And it tells girls over and over that how their body looks to others is more important than how that body feels to themselves. And whereas I think those of us who are Gen X or baby boom parents would have seen that as a message to push back against, to protest, that kind of self-objectification, that kind of sexualization. It's sold to today's girls, and this is where the book's not there, reflexively. The complicated and the subtitle comes in. It's sold to girls as a form of empowerment, of personal empowerment and self-confidence, and often the most salient form of personal empowerment and self-confidence. So I talked to a girl, for instance, who was telling me, she showed me a picture of herself going to a party, and she was wearing, you know, a little crop top and a mini skirt and 6-inch heels, and she said, I'm proud of my body, and I never feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothes. But then a few minutes later, she told me that a year earlier she wouldn't have worn that outfit because she was 25 pounds heavier. And as she put it, some jerky guys would have called me the fat girl. And so then, you know, you have to kind of ask young women, who gets to be proud of which body and under what circumstances, and how liberating can you say that is when the threat of ridicule lurks right around the corner?
So what about the bases these days? What are we talking about when we're talking about first base, second base?
That was one of the places where I went, what? Because all of a sudden, oral sex, female to male only, of course, got thrown in there. Where did I say it was? At base 3? Was that, yeah, it had become...
Somewhere there, 2, 3.
Yeah, it had become oral sex. That was kind of a shock because that wasn't even in the... I mean, I want to talk about challenging the baseball metaphor, too.
Can we? Sure.
Yeah, I mean, the baseball metaphor is not... that's, I think, thing one that we can do to change the conversation around girls and boys. Get rid of the baseball metaphor. There was a boy who said at one point in the book towards the end, this is like skipping way to the end, but this boy said, in baseball there's winners and there's losers. Who's supposed to be the loser in sex? And, you know, it was why I ended in a co-ed classroom, again, skipping way ahead, but it was because, I wanted to see kids working that out together, and to have a boy say that and just make that shift in his head from being an adversary to a partner. And really, I think when you think about the baseball thing, I think girls are actually the field. I don't think they're the other team, right?
No, there is no other team.
There is no other team. It's the field. So what I talk about in the book is Al Vernacchio's metaphor, which is sex is a pizza. Yeah? And you know that one? It's the best metaphor because pizza, you know, is a shared experience where everybody's invested in, you know, having a good time. So, like, first you decide if you want to go out to pizza, right? And then if you want to go out to pizza, maybe you like pepperoni and I like mushrooms, so maybe we go halvesies, but we negotiate, and maybe we have pepperoni this time and mushrooms next time, or maybe you keep insisting on pepperoni and I'm a vegetarian and, you know, I'm not going to have pizza with you anymore, or, you know. There's just so many ways that you can go to talk about an experience that's mutual, reciprocal, where everybody's invested in the other person having an equally good time, where you communicate, where there's shared joy. I mean, it's so much better. So, thing number one, all of you, sex is a pizza.
Not baseball. But you've said that what they were considering, I don't know. Let's not call them bases. Let's just call them stages. No, nature is of a relationship when it comes to sex or dating. What are we looking at?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that question.
When it comes to dating, sex or relationships...
Well, dating is last.
Dating is last.
So that would, you know, particularly in college, but increasingly in high school, kids are living in a hookup culture. And we have to step back when we talk about that and first of all say, hookup has no meaning. That word has actually no meaning. It can be kissing, it can be oral sex, it can be vaginal intercourse, it can be anything. And every time I talk to a young person and they say, well, so then I hooked up with so-and-so, I have to say, stop, define your terms. And they actually don't know what one another means when they talk about hooking up because kids tend to overestimate what their peers are doing because it's purposely ambiguous. So that they don't, you know, distances them, and then they don't exactly know what's going on there. What hookup culture is this? So, kids today did not invent casual sex. Please, what is different is the idea that it's normalized, that sex proceeds rather than rises out of intimacy as the norm, and in college and increasingly in high schools. You may choose to be part of that culture, you may choose to embrace that culture, you may choose to opt out of that culture, but you have to define yourself in relationship to that culture and figure out your sexuality in relationship to that norm.
Were you able in all your discussions to formulate an idea of why? Why rather than dating first? Why the switch?
Why that happened? I don't know why that happened. I know kind of when it happened.
When did it happen?
Kind of just, it escalated in the 90s and towards the late 90s.
Along with the internet? Or no?
Yeah, but the correlation's not causation. You know, I don't know why that happened. That's a good question. But girls had all kinds of different ways of talking about it. And some, you know, one of the things that was important to me was to let them have their own voice about these issues, about these ideas. So when we were talking about pop culture and hotness and all of that, I would argue, you know, that we would argue with each other about, you know, Nicki Minaj versus Lena Dunham, who was subversive and who was, you know, not, and who was limiting and who was liberating and all these things. So with hookup culture, some girls would come in, sit down and say to me, I'm tired of seeing girls portrayed as a victim, as victims of the hookup culture. I'm a participant. This serves me. I don't want a boyfriend. I don't have time for a boyfriend. I want to just hang out with my friends and have a good time, and this is the way that I'm going to do it. You know, which, okay. And what I became invested in, for me, because I don't feel like it's my job to tell you hookup's good, hookup's bad, relationship's good, relationship's bad, but was to say what you are likely to, what a girl is likely to get or not get out of a hookup. And so what you're likely to get is a war story, a conquest, a feeling of being desirable for a night, a warm body, an adrenaline rush. What you're probably not going to get is good sex or the practice with the tools that you need to have good sex or create intimacy. Hmm. So know that going in.
Right. So I know that a lot of people here are wondering, where does porn play into all this?
Oh, it doesn't.
It doesn't?
Not at all. No, I'm just kidding.
I was like, I read the book.
You know, it's been a long book tour, and sometimes I just got to mess with a person. I can't help myself.
I'm like, I read the book. I feel like you...
Yeah, okay. No, I'm just... No, porn, how, yes. Porn has been a game changer. It really has. And one of the things in the, that you see in the research is that there was a survey done of college students, a national survey in England, actually, that found that 60% of them say that they consult porn in part as sex education, even as 75% said they know it's about as realistic as pro wrestling. So, you know, I think that that happens for a number of reasons. I mean, when we have this culture that is littered with female body parts, where women's bodies are used to sell everything, where sex is everywhere, where they can access it on the internet younger, they can access porn younger, it's more explicit because it's, you know, competitive. And yet we never have frank, honest discussions with young people about sex. So it's all out there, and it's not in here. So kids, when they don't have it in schools, they don't have it from their parents, they would tell me they would look at porn, you know, girls would say things like, I didn't know how to give a blowjob, so I looked at porn to figure out how. Or I didn't know how the pieces, you know, the parts fit together, so I looked at porn to figure out how. But it's really, it's not where we want kids, you know, it's to get their sex education. It's more of that performative sexuality, sexiness for women, distorted bodies, distorted attitudes. And young women would say to me, I mean, it's, I guess on the sort of more benign, if you will, end, a number of young women said to me, my boyfriend wants to know why I don't make noises like the women in porn when we have sex. And I would get so frustrated, not with them, but with the idea that they asked that, you know, that that was a question, that my kind of journalistic remove would crumble. And I would say, look, it's a movie. And a movie has to have a soundtrack. Or it's a silent movie. You know? So somebody's got to make noise. And that would be like a revelation. And then on the kind of more extreme end, what we've been seeing is a significant rise in anal sex among kids. And, you know, I don't want to demonize a particular behavior, but we're talking about young women, and we haven't gotten to this, but I imagine we will, that, you know, for the most part have not masturbated, have not had an orgasm, have not had an orgasm with a partner, cannot talk about their needs and desires and limits with their partner. And when you look into the research on this, what you find is there was a survey of kids 16 to 18, so high school age kids, and what they found was that... the rise in anal sex was driven by young men who were not doing it as an act of intimacy with a partner, but kind of to check it off the bucket list, like you know, the goal-oriented basis idea.
Phase five.
Yes, that was what they called it. And that they were doing it to compete with other boys, and that they believed that they would have to and could coerce their partner into it. And that and the girls reported that it hurt. And what was interesting was that both the girls and the boys blamed that the pain on the girls, saying that they were naive or flawed or unable to relax. So, you know, a lot of this, the way that I put it in the book, is in terms of this idea that really intrigued me, that was this idea of intimate justice. And that was an idea that, a phrase that was coined by Sarah McLelland, who is a psychologist at University of Michigan. And it's, you know, just like the ways that who does the dishes in your house or who vacuums the rug is in part a political issue, right? We've been talking about this forever, you know, in the women's movement. Sex, too, has those dynamics. And so you have to ask, who's entitled to engage sexually? Who's entitled to enjoy it? Who is the primary beneficiary of a sexual experience, and how each partner defines good enough. And I think that truly those questions are thorny for adult women. But when you're talking about girls and their early formative experiences that will follow them as they get older, it's especially important because, you know, I don't want girls' early experiences to be something that they have to get over.
Would you say that porn is making women or young women desensitized to potential violence that could happen to them? Like, makes it more normative?
Yeah, you know, that's actually, the research shows that both young men and young women who regularly consume porn are more likely to believe rape myths, like that a woman asked for it because of the way that she dressed or because of how much she drank. And young women are less likely to both step in if they see a potential assault in progress, and less likely to recognize themselves when they're in a dangerous situation. And that may be because one of the things that porn often does is eroticize humiliation and degradation of women.
Right. So how would you, I mean, what can a parent say to a child?
Well, I think the first
thing
when it comes
to porn,
with porn, is that you got to get out in front of it. I mean, you know, talking about it, I'm going to be on the radio. I can't say this. This is going on the radio, right? Okay. I can't tell stories about my daughter when I'm going to be on the radio. I promise her I wouldn't do that. But I will say that when we talked about porn, you know, I said to her, look, you know, like when you see violence on TV or violence in movies, it's not real, right? It's like you can tell it's fake and they shoot and there's blood and it's not real. It's not what's really happened. Same thing here. This is not real. And but I realized actually that a few weeks after we had that conversation, I think this is not telling a story on her, but a few weeks after we had that conversation, we were watching the movie Brooklyn. And that was a great movie. I love that movie. And it had a very ordinary Hollywood sex scene in it, in which, you know, there was like a few seconds of kissing. Everybody ripped their clothes off or half their clothes off. Then there's like maybe 5 to 10 seconds of what appears to be intercourse, and then everybody's happy. And it occurred to me after having the porn conversation that she was going to see way more of this image, you know, that sequence, than porn, probably, and that was just as unrealistic. And so I said, you know how when you watch a movie and somebody takes a cab ride, you see them get into the cab, and then you see them get out of the cab, right? You don't see the whole ride in between, because that would take up the whole movie and it would be tedious. Similarly, when Hollywood has, I know it's funny, but it's a really good metaphor for kids, right? Hollywood has symbols that it uses, and they're very heteronormative symbols, and they're very male-oriented symbols for what sex is. And you're going to see those symbols over and over, but just like the cab ride, that's just used to signal somebody has had sex. It's not what sex is. So I think it's equally important, actually, to challenge the images that they see in everyday pop, in everyday music videos, in everyday advertising, as it is to challenge the images in porn.
I mean, one of the things that you wrote about a lot in the book is that you've kept encountering young women who didn't necessarily expect to feel any kind of pleasure in any kind of sexual encounter. If they were performing oral sex, they certainly didn't expect to get it back.
Right, and it's again back to that intimate justice. Who's the primary beneficiary? And particularly with oral sex, it was very clear, both among the girls I talked to and in research, that the primary beneficiary was the boy. And girls had a lot of reasons, again, in trying to surface how they talked about it, about why they were willing to perform non-reciprocal oral sex. And sometimes it was because they liked a boy and they, you know, wanted to satisfy him. Sometimes it was because it made them feel powerful. Sometimes it was because of popularity. Sometimes it was because they just wanted to end an evening and they didn't want to have intercourse and they didn't know what to do and they were being pushed. And, you know, but so there were all kinds of reasons. But after hearing a lot of these stories, again, my journalistic resolve sort of crumbled, and I started, you know, this was my metaphor that I started using with them for that. I started saying, look, these were feminist girls, these were forthright girls, these were girls who could bandy about words like, you know, slut-shaming and heteronormativity all over the place. I said, look, if you were alone, every time you were alone with a boy, he asked you to go get a glass of water from the kitchen, and he never offered to get you a glass of water, or he just went, you want me to, you know, get you a glass of water? Like, really, you know, begrudgingly? You would not stand for it.
And they would laugh, and they would say, yeah, well, when you put it that way. And I would say, well, you know, maybe you should put it that way, that you think it's less insulting to go get water than to perform a sex act. But it was a lot about what they had learned, about this idea that it was okay to engage in sexual behavior, but not okay to enjoy it. And when we talked about things going the other way, it wasn't just that boys didn't want to. It was that girls also felt very uncomfortable with it because they had learned very negative feelings. Both sexes had learned very negative feelings about female genitals. And in the book, what I talk about is, I call it the psychological clitoridectomy that we perform on girls. Because when we have our kids, when we have infant boys and infant girls, parents of infant boys tend to name all the body parts. They tend to at least say, there's your pee-pee, something. But when we have girls, we go right from navel to knees. And then they go into... So, you know, there's no better way to make something unspeakable than to not give it a name. Then they go into puberty education class. And they learn that boys have erections and ejaculations, and girls have periods and unwanted pregnancy. And they see the internal diagram that looks kind of like a steer's head, you know? And it grays out between the legs. And they never say vulva. They never say clitoris. No surprise, again, you know, fewer than half of girls 14 to 17 have ever masturbated. And then we think that when they go into partnered encounters, that they're going to feel a sense of equality somehow, that they're going to be able to have voice, that they're going to be able to articulate their wants, that they're going to be able to articulate their limits, that they're going to think it's about them. It's not really very realistic. We've set them up for that.
So how does that relate to trends in pubic hair?
Trends in pubic hair. Well, yeah, the only time... So pubic hair is a vanishing breed. It has... A lot of the girls that I spoke with, you know, got rid of it before it was there. And it was the only time that they went down there was to shave it. You know, they never looked, they never touched except to remove. And that's become a very... And they would talk about it. They would say, well, it makes me feel cleaner. But then again, you know, just like with the girl who had put on the 25 pounds and wouldn't wear the skimpy outfit, when we talked further, they would also express a fear of humiliation. They would express a fear that, you know, they heard some boys talking about a girl who had pubic hair and how grossed out they were. Or one of the college professors that I talked to, Debbie Herbenick at Indiana University, said that in one of her classes, a boy said, if a hookup partner ever had pubic hair, I'd walk out the door. And another of her students who was female emailed her and said that day she went home and took it off. You know, that it was, and, you know, that there were, on college campuses, you see signboards saying, you know, get your spring break wax or that kind of thing. And it really, what interested me, I guess, was I thought about how we started shaving our armpits and legs. And that happened in the 1920s because fashions for the first time showed our limbs, flapper fashions. And so the taking off of the hair was in part about a new level of public scrutiny. And so I can't help but think that there is an aspect to this. And of course, porn, you know, in porn, nobody has pubic hair because it gets in the way of the shot. That's why they took it off. It wasn't like for any other reason. It was just, you know, they were trying to see. But it's about a new public scrutiny of young women's genitals and a new feeling that they need to be prepared and will be looked at, and that it's about how they look rather than how they feel again. And although it's not big, and I don't mean to go into an alarmist territory, but there has, since the pubic hair trend has, removing pubic hair trend has begun, and again, that was, took off really after an episode of Sex and the City in early 2000s, there's been a rise in labiaplasty, which was a word I had to look up. I don't know if y'all know, but it's like the surgical trimming of the inner or outer lips of the vulva. And it's not for sexual functioning. And the most popular, this is the best part, right? The most popular look when they're going for it is called the Barbie. Yeah, because Barbie, they call it a clamshell effect because Barbie is A, made of plastic, and B, doesn't have a vagina. So that's what the ideal is. But just the idea that, and plastic, the head of the American Aesthetic Plastic Surgery, whatever it's called, you know, said this is a new way that women are expressing confidence. It's a new way to express confidence. And I'll tell you, if you have a daughter who's like feeling anxious about this kind of stuff, there's this art project that you can see online. It's in England. It's called The Great Wall of Vagina, I believe it's called. And I really wanted my publisher to make it the cover of my book, but they declined. And it's just walls of plaster casts of women's vulvas. And it's like a fingerprint, you know? I mean, it's just like, it's as varied as a fingerprint. And to just see, you know, 800 vulvas in plaster is a way to reinforce that idea that we're all normal. Mm-hmm. We're all normal, just the way we are.
Let's talk about what virginity is today and how girls are thinking about their virginity. What did you find there?
Well, virginity is still defined by first intercourse, and I think that we need to challenge that idea a little bit, because not that first intercourse isn't a big deal, but it's not the only big deal. And in fact, rates of intercourse and the age of first intercourse have not really changed, but what has changed is are these other behaviors, such as oral sex, that are happening more often and younger. And when we don't talk about those ideas to kids, then it makes it so that those things count as not sex. You know, kids say, well, it's not really sex, and it's no big deal. And then it's not subject to the same rules around consent, around coercion, and it opens the door to a lot of risky behavior and a lot of very disrespectful behavior. So it also, when we reduce virginity and reduce sex, I mean, somebody said to me that, there's Deborah Rothman, who's a sex educator, said it's like using the word vegetable for celery. And then you don't talk about any other vegetables, because every time you say vegetable, you mean celery. It doesn't make any sense. You just miss everything. So when we talk about sex and just mean intercourse, we're not only missing all the things that heterosexual kids engage in, but we're missing, we're completely dismissing what lesbian girls do. And so at one point, I was talking to a girl who had never had heterosexual sex and heterosexual intercourse, and I said, so how did you know when you weren't a virgin anymore? She said she had to Google it. And Google didn't know. So she said, so I said, well, what did you decide? And she hemmed and she hawed for a while, and she said, you know, I decided that I wasn't a virgin anymore when I had my first orgasm with a partner. And I thought, wow, you know, what if that for one second was our definition of virginity? It would completely change how we thought about sex. And again, it's this idea that sex is a pool of experiences, like a pizza. It's a pool of experiences, you know, that are about warmth, that are about affection, that are about desire, that are about communication, that are about sensation, and not this race to check things off your bucket list. And, you know, saying to a young person, really, who has more sexual experience? Who's more experienced? The person who spends 3 hours kissing a partner and experimenting with erotic tension and sensation and communication, or the person who gets wasted, hooks up with a random, and unloads their virginity because they want to get rid of it before they go to college.
But what if a parent is... I think a lot of the virginity message often comes from a parent wanting their kid to delay, to delay, to delay. Is there a way for parents to encourage their kids to keep their virginity until they want to lose it in whatever way they want to lose it without freaking them out or shaming them in some way?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the key is to start these conversations with kids early and often. And they're not just, I mean, they're about sex and they're not about sex. You know, they're about even saying to a girl, what do you want out of an experience? You know, I mean, sometimes it's hard for parents to do this. I know this. Sometimes you have to enlist, you have to get your team in place. And I know that I've been that team member for my friends sometimes. And there was a girl that, a friend of mine whose daughter was 16, thinking about having intercourse with her boyfriend, and she said, would you go out and talk to her? And so we went out, and, you know, like everybody, I wanted the floor to swallow me up rather than say these words. But I walk my talk, and I said, look, you know, I know you're thinking about this. And let's have the conversation first about safety, about contraception, about disease protection, about consent, about all those things. But now let me ask you a few questions, and you don't have to answer them, but just think about them. Have you masturbated? Have you had an orgasm on your own? Have you had an orgasm with your partner? Can you talk to your partner freely about sex? Can you talk to him and tell him what you want, what you need, what you don't like, what you don't want, what your limits are? And if you're answering no to those questions, why are you having sexual intercourse? Why? What do you want out of sexual experience? What are you trying to do here? What is the, you know, what do you want for you? And I can't say that I know what her answers were, because I did not make her say, and she did not. But she sat there with her eyes like this big. And that young woman is 24 now, and we talk constantly. We talk about her sex life. We talk about her job. We talk about her applications to graduate school that she's writing now. And I feel like that conversation, that first conversation, opened a door where I signaled to her that we could talk in the most intimate way about anything. And it's not really enough to say, you know, if you have any questions, I'm here. Because that's putting the onus on our kids. And we do that, you know, that tends to be what we do. So again, you know, if you can't do that, you have to talk to somebody else. And the more kids, I mean, it's very clear, and we can talk about the Dutch soon, I think, probably too, that the more kids know, the more educated they are, the more girls understand their entitlement in sexuality, the more they understand that they're not there to provide pleasure, the more discerning they become, the more responsible they become, the more they choose their liaisons with care and have the experiences that they want to have.
We haven't even touched on date rape and a lot of the stuff that you talk about what happens when you go to college. And we're running out of time, and I want to leave time for your questions.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
but, I mean, where to even begin? You give the statistic, I should read it to you, it's here, that kids who go to college, oh, here it is, 2015 survey found that half of female undergraduates were victims of non-consensual sexual contact once they went to college. And for me, that was a shocking number. Half of them reported that to be true. What should parents be talking about with kids before they go to college if that is what's being reported from being at college?
Well, you know, again, I think part of that is the way that we set sex up. When you set sex up as a baseball game, when girls' limits are a challenge to be overcome, you know, when girls see themselves as there to provide male pleasure, you have this inequity in the relationship that leads to a lot more coercion and forced contact and all the way to an entitlement to rape. And we need to talk to our sons about that, first of all. I mean, it's, you know, as girls will say to you all the time, the only thing that 100% of rapes have in common is a rapist. And the other piece of the statistics is that on college campus, I mean, that's talking about a lot of a variety of coercion. And I had a conversation with a girl at one point who was telling me that she felt, you know, grateful, maybe the wrong word, but she had never been raped. And I said, well, have you ever been coerced into oral sex? And she said, oh, well, yeah, you know, that was, she wasn't counting that. And she told me this story. I was talking about the shoulder push, which was a big thing that girls would talk about. And she was telling me about, you know, going back to this guy's room, and they were making out, and he kept pushing, and she kept saying no, and he kept pushing, and she kept saying no. And the third time he got angry, said, screw you, kicked her out of his room. It was 2 a.m. She was in a very cold climate, and she had to walk 2 miles home. And she cried the whole way. And yet she hadn't made the connection to that being a non-consensual form of sex.
Mm-hmm. Why is date rape still so hard for young women to report?
because they get stigmatized, because they it's not really a way to win friends and influence people. It doesn't make you popular, you know. I mean, it's not easy, because they think they'll be blamed, because they were drunk, because they have not seen people effectively punished. And I think one of the great, you know, one of the things that I thought I could add to the conversation on assault, and, you know, it was really hard for me because I didn't want my book to be taken over by assault. And it was what I, and the story of sexual assault was breaking the activism to combat it on campus, the argument about the activism, the is it, you know, the boys suing, the girls suing, everybody suing, was happening while I was reporting, and it was moving very quickly. And it became very important to me to say, okay, we're having this umbrella conversation about assault, but what happens after yes? And that we needed to look more at what happened in consensual encounters to understand the dynamics of some of the non-consensual encounters that we were seeing. So again, you know, I mean, I felt in the non-consensual encounters that what I could add as somebody who's been around in this world of girls now for quite a long time was history. And it was really important to me to look at and provide in that chapter the arc of activism around assault that started in the late 80s and was stopped, really squashed, and now has started up again, and how it's different and how it's the same and what we can learn and how we can move forward with both boys and girls.
A lot of the book talks about, you have many chapters that talk about an arc of where things have come from, where they go. Did, when you were talking to any of these women, was there anything, any story that they were sharing where you said, I relate to that, that's how it was when I was young?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that to them because that would be inappropriate.
When I was your age.
I'm an interviewer. I agree. Sure, of course. You know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of things that they talked about in terms of trying to figure out how to, you know, be the agents and the subjects of their own sexuality. I think we all have struggled with that. And in some ways, you know, people will say to me, well, you know, things haven't really changed. You know, the women and girls have always struggled with these things. And I think, yeah, but when so much has changed elsewhere, when so much has changed for us professionally, when so much has changed in our homes, when so much has changed in our schools and our education and our expectations and our earning, and, you know, in so many ways we've made progress, not all the way progress, but progress, why is this the one area where we're willing to say, oh, well, it's always been like that?
I would like to end on some sort of positive note.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Dutch.
The Dutch.
The Dutch are extraordinary at educating young people about sex.
I know.
What are they doing that we're not doing?
I think it's in the wooden shoes. I think that we need to...
and the treats that appear there.
Yeah. So one of the things I end, as I said, I end the book in a co-educational classroom, and I actually end it on the image of a boy because I feel, obviously, that boys need to be more than included in this conversation. You know, they are part of the conversation. And part of what I looked into was, you know, sort of what works. And one of the things that I found was comparisons of Dutch college women and American college women. So comparing similar demographics, talking about their early sexual experiences. And what they found in those studies is that by every measure, whether you're talking about reducing negative consequences like pregnancy, like regret, like disease, or whether you're talking about enhancing positive consequences like delaying intercourse, or knowing your partner very well, or enjoying the experience, or preparing responsibly, or, you know, having a positive body image, everything, you name it, everything that we want for our girls, the Dutch are superior. So, why? Well, Dutch parents, teachers, and doctors talk early, often, and frankly to their kids about sex and relationships. And one of the really salient differences that struck me as a mom, not just as a journalist, was that while Dutch parents were not necessarily more comfortable talking about sex than American parents, American parents, and here we are mostly talking about moms, because as girls would say to me, fathers just make lame jokes. Dutch fathers do talk to their kids, though. American parents emphasized risk and danger. Dutch parents talk about balancing responsibility and joy. And that shift seemed to make the main difference in the daughters having agency in their sexuality, feeling that they could articulate needs, wants, desires, and limits, feeling they could enjoy themselves, feeling that they could be in a loving relationship. And in fact, with boys, one thing that Amy Shallett, who's a sociologist in Massachusetts, found, she compared the Dutch and Americans too and found that among boys, American boys will say that they want love and emotional connection with a partner, but they consider it a personal quirk and not one that their peers share, that other boys share. Dutch boys say, of course I would want to care about my partner. Of course I would love my partner. Of course girls should want to be doing this as much as I do. Of course they should enjoy this as much as I do. Of course you wouldn't want to be drunk. My father taught me all of that. Of course they did. So the lesson is move to the Netherlands. No. The lesson is that talking to your kids, you know, is essential, that we can start very young, naming their body parts, talking to them about personal limits, talking to them about how babies are made or fetal development, and opening the door to those conversations that we can then continue throughout their lives.
So I'm going to ask just a couple more questions. So if you have a question that you want to ask, start coming up to one of these two microphones right here. Who is Karis Dennison?
Oh, Karis. Karis Dennison is, you can hire her. She'll come up here to your school, too. Karis Dennison is the educator that I followed. And she calls herself a youth advocate, not a sex educator. She makes that distinction because she, you know, she really feels that she's in kids' corner. And she had all these different, she was the one in whose class the boy said the thing about the baseball, that, you know, the winners and the losers. And she has all kinds of exercises and ideas that I talk about in the book that get kids talking amongst themselves about these issues. And one of the things that she says that I really like is that we need to treat life more like an English exam. So what she means is that these kids who are so bright and so, you know, ambitious and so educated, they would never go into an English test without knowing what book they were being tested on. And yet they will go to a party without even an idea of what they don't want to happen. You know? So to use the skills that you have in your academic life to think about, you know, consciously, I'm going out tonight. What do I not want to happen? What do I want to happen? How might I get there? And then, you know, if it ends up being really awful, saying, why did that happen? Revise, you know, redraft, write another draft, do it again next time differently. You know, so just take some of those skills that we've honed so well with kids and teach them how to apply it in their personal lives.
There are several young women here tonight. What would you want them to take away if they can remember one thing from walking out of this room tonight?
Well, sex is a pizza. That they, you know, have every... You know, one thing that I thought about the other day about the sex is a pizza, I'd never thought about this before, but girls so often, one of the things Karis talks about is fallbacks. Fallbacks are your default behavior when you're under stress. And so for a lot of young women, the fallback is silence. For a lot of young women, the fallback is whatever you want, right? You know, which movie do you want to see? Whichever one you want to see. So the only problem with the pizza metaphor is if you say to the person, I don't have an opinion, whatever you want. You got to have an opinion about the pizza, girls. You got to have a sense of your toppings. And you have to know what you want to eat and what you don't want to eat.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Anna Dramatic Pause Tatashev for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.